Have you ever tried to confront someone about something they've done wrong? I mean, I'm not a confrontational person. This makes my skin crawl just thinking about it. But you try to confront someone about something they've done wrong, only to have them evade or deny or dodge responsibility. If you've ever had the pleasure of raising a teenager, or you've ever had a particularly lippy toddler, you know what I'm talking about. It's not just them, but the question that they tend to use is, well, what did I do wrong? And no matter how many times you try to explain what they've done wrong, or try to help them remember what they've done, or it just doesn't work, right? Nothing is getting through. It goes in one ear and out the other. And eventually, you will get to the point that they will turn it around on you. And they will say something along the lines of, well, you never told me, you know, you just told me to not use fireworks in the driveway. You didn't say anything about the kitchen. And so, I mean, right, you never told me, or you're always too critical, or you're always breathing down my neck, something along those lines. And unfortunately, some people never grow out of that, right? Some people never grow out of that stage of life. Maybe it's because of how they were raised, their parents didn't hold them to that, or maybe it's because they're just particularly hard-headed, or whatever. But being around adults who are still like that, oh, man, it is an exercise in patience. To put it mildly, it's an exercise in patience working with people who never do anything wrong in their own eyes, right? So imagine how God must feel. Imagine being in God's shoes and hearing the same arguments over and over, the same defenses over and over again, even though God clearly knows what's going on, he's hearing the same excuses. That argument, that discussion, is essentially what the book of Malachi is. It is God's people showing apathy towards him and his law, and they're arguing back and forth with the God of the universe about what is right and what is wrong. And if only it were limited to these people. Like, if it were just these people in this place at this time, it would be educational. It wouldn't be particularly applicable to us. We may not have the discussions out loud the way that they tend to, but if we're honest with ourselves, I'll bet we can all think of sometimes, some occasions, when we've tried to justify our misbehavior to God. Times that we've tried to explain away our guilt, or deny our responsibility, or convince God that what we've done wrong is not that big a deal, right? And this morning, if you can identify with that, God has a message for you and for me. So the book of Malachi it's the last of the minor prophets. It's the last book in the Old Testament. It's the last of the minor prophets. It's written about, we don't get an exact date or anything to give us indications, but based on what he says, we can kind of get some clues. And based on those clues, we think it's written about 100 years after the Israelites returned from Babylonian captivity. They've returned from captivity. If you read the book of Nehemiah, the walls have been built. The homes have been rebuilt. The economy is sort of back up and running. They've even rebuilt the temple by this point, which is what we talked about in some of the previous minor prophets. And they were sent into Babylonian captivity because of their idolatry. They were worshiping other gods, all sorts of other gods. And so all that has sort of taken place in the past. And now everything is sort of normal. At least it looks good on the surface, right? You've got people living their lives, worshiping the temple. Everything looks good on the surface. But it looks not so good beneath the surface. You scratch a little deeper, and you find out that the people are struggling, right? They are looking around. They're struggling to get by, and they're looking around at the nations who surround them, people who are not God worshipers at all, at least not the God. And they're looking at all those folks who are living like wild, decadent, sinful, open sin lives. And those folks, those other folks, seem to be doing just fine. And it starts to look to them like maybe God doesn't really care about his law. If the people who are so lawless are doing good, maybe God doesn't really care about this law and blessing and all that stuff. So listen to how God opens up to his people and their response to him. "I have loved you," says the Lord, "but you ask, how have you loved us?" Whew, do you feel the tension in this like short little verse? How have you loved us? Just imagine having this conversation with your parent, right? Your mother or father. Imagine, and some of you grow up, like I did, in a more reserved home where open declarations of affection were not common. But imagine that your mother or even your, maybe especially your father, opening up and saying, "Son, I love you," or "Daughter, I love you," and you responding with, "How?" I will never forget the fateful day that I made the mistake of questioning whether or not my mother loved us. I say I'll never forget it. Parts of it get real fuzzy. But my mom was working around the house, and my mom is like super sweet, and she's working around the house, and she keeps getting on to me and my brother for doing nothing, and it was something or other. I don't remember what it was. But I was getting old enough that I thought I was pretty big, and I came up with a pretty snappy retort, if I do say so myself. It was supposed to make, the theory behind this was that it was supposed to make her see just how unfair she was treating us. I was hoping for something along the lines of, "Oh, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that." It's not what I got. In retrospect, it was not just a bad decision. It was a bad decision. It's a mistake that I never made again. Because I remember when I spoke those words, the look on my mom's face. Yes, there was anger. Yes, there was frustration. But there was a lot of hurt in my mom's face when I said what I said. But here stand the Israelites, the people God has loved and guided and protected and provided for, the God who led them out of slavery, brought them into a nation, granted them victory over more superior enemies, made them into a prosperous nation, the God who didn't give up on them when for centuries they were living in open disobedience and defiance. Those Israelites now stand toe to toe with that God and say, "How have you loved us?" And this launches God into a whole series that makes up the rest of the book of Malachi, a whole series of accusations and explanations, right? Trying to explain, well, this is what you've done wrong. And he explains it to them, and the premise is, look, I know you've done all this, and still I've chosen you. Still I've chosen you. Even though I know all this bad stuff about you, I still choose you. Now, to be fair to the Israelites, the things God that confronts them about would be pretty easy to dismiss. I mean, it would be like getting pulled over and the officer saying, "It looks like your window tint is 1% too dark." And you're like, come on now, right? It looks like, you know, you took a rock on your brake light and it's, you know, it's not fully enclosed anymore. Come, that just happened, right? So it was things like that. In their minds, it's things like that, things that are easy to dismiss. All this stuff would have been no big deal to them. But to God, it's not just a big deal. It's what's called a deal breaker. Because the thing they did, the first thing they did, was to disrespect God in their worship. God says this: a son honors his father, a slave honors his master. If I am the father, where is the honor due me? If I am a master, where is the respect due me, says the Lord Almighty? It is your priests who show contempt for my name. But you ask, how have we shown contempt for your name? I mean, you can hear this argument, right? Maybe you've even been in this argument before. How have we shown contempt for your name? And God tells them. God's like, he goes on, he says, I see what you're doing. Like, I can see it with my own eyes. And sometimes, even that's not enough if you've been in the discussion. Like, I saw what you did. No, you didn't. Yes, I did. You're not going to gaslight me into telling me I didn't see it. I see what you're doing. And with my own eyes, I see that the offerings you are bringing to my temple, that the animals are blind, that they are lame, that they are diseased animals. And by that, I don't mean that they're not cool. I mean, when I say that they're lame, I mean that they are crippled, like they're missing a leg, something along those lines. When God says they're blind, it's not just that the animals are, particularly dense and they're just running into stuff. No, there's something wrong with them. When God says they're diseased, he doesn't mean they have a cold at the time. These are the rejects, the animals that they're bringing. And don't get me wrong, the people are still technically making the sacrifices. The temple was still functioning, right? People were going to worship, they were bringing the animals, they were making the sacrifice, things were being offered, but it was the things that they didn't want anyway. Imagine you and I are close friends, and every so often you and I, we exchange gifts because we mean a lot to one another. And you've been thinking about the perfect gift for me, and you have thought about it and thought about it, and then you worked on it, like for weeks and for months. You have made this thing with your hand, and you're like, boy, this is the perfect thing for Dustin. I'm going to make it, and he's going to love it, and you give it to me, and it is just as you thought it would be. It is exactly what fits me and suits me. It's the right thing, and I'm like, oh, thank you so much. And I got this for you. I dug it out of the back of my closet. My grandma gave it to me 10 years ago, and I never wanted it anyway. How would you feel if I responded to your gift that way? By giving you something I never wanted in the first place. Wouldn't you feel robbed, cheated, disrespected? But that's what these people were doing to God. And not just with their animal sacrifices. Later on in chapter 3, he says this: will a mere mortal rob God? But you rob me, and you ask, how are we robbing you? Seeing the way this goes now? How are we robbing you? And he says, in tithes and offerings. You're under a curse, whole nation, because you are robbing me. You want to know why things are bad? It's because you're robbing me. Bring the whole tithe into the storehouse that there may be food in my house. Now, we think about tithes and offerings primarily in dollars, right? Whether it's literal dollar bills or done through a debit card and our online giving, and all that is important. But for them, tithing was not just about the money, whatever money I earned this week. Most of them, they were in an agrarian economy, an agricultural economy. So what they would be like, okay, this is the harvest I took in this week. I'm going to give one-tenth of my harvest, what I made, I'm going to bring that to God. So there would be literal food in the storehouse. And out of this storehouse, the priests would eat because they didn't have land. The tribe of Levi was not given land. So they would eat off of this. And God's like, you aren't bringing that. I know you're not bringing that. You're saying, you just made a little when I know how much you made. So they were giving, but in their minds, at least, giving God the leftovers was good enough. That the heart of their giving didn't really matter. And by the way, it should be noted that the pagans, the people who didn't worship God at all, the ones who live all around them, some of them actually live in Israel, those people weren't giving God anything. They weren't giving God anything, and they're doing just fine. So shouldn't my something be better than their nothing? You notice the comparison game going on here? And maybe you've caught yourself doing that. That when you do something or act in a way or think in a way or behave in a way that you know is not great, the little math that goes on in your head goes something like this: I may not be great, but I'm better than so-and-so. And as long as I'm better than those people or that person, I should be okay. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. Me too, buddy. Me too. I've thought the same thing myself. I'll compare myself to, you know, whoever I have to compare myself to be better than them. Those people go to my church and I'm way better at this than they are. Those people live on my block and I'm way better at this than them. These people live in my nation, vaguely, and I've seen them on TV, and I'm way better than them. Those folks are on the other side of the world, and I'm sure I'm better than them because they don't do any of this, right? So they're thinking their something ought to be better than nothing. So what if my gift is less than ideal? At least I'm giving something. That's what's going on in their heads. But these actions and these attitudes are blatantly disrespecting God. Because they're treating God as if he doesn't matter. So it isn't surprising when that's their attitude towards God. It's not surprising when that just sort of bleeds over into the rest of their lives. Other people were doing just fine. And look how they treated one another. You have wearied the Lord with your words. How have we wearied him, you ask? By saying, all who do evil in the good are good in the eyes of the Lord. In other words, God doesn't care. All those people are doing evil and it's good with God. All who do evil are good in the eyes of the Lord. He's pleased with them. Or where is the God of justice? Where is the God of justice? Clearly, God must not care how we treat one another because evil people are prospering. So God must not care. And if you think God doesn't care about others, why should you care about others? You find a loophole that you can take advantage of someone else? God doesn't care. There's a way to abuse the poor, the widow, the orphan, the foreigner, the stranger. It doesn't matter. You can use them and lose them. They are just there for your benefit. And even in their own thing, this is not just the others. This is all others, not just those folks out there. This is the way they started treating folks in their own family. He says, "You flood the Lord's altar with tears. You weep and wail because he no longer looks with favor upon your offerings or accepts them with pleasure from your hands." And you ask why? You go to you go to church. You put your money in the plate or your food or whatever offering, your animal. You come and suppose you even give a full amount and you give that and God's not accepting it. He's not happy with it. Things are still going bad. You're like, why is this happening, God? This is God's response. It's because the Lord is the witness between you and the wife of your youth. You have been unfaithful to her, though she is your partner, the wife of your marriage covenant. They were turning their backs on their wives. They were putting away their wives just because, look, I can get a newer model for cheaper. Right? Treating their wives like flat screen TVs. I can get something better than I have now at Walmart for cheaper than I paid for this. And so they were turning their backs on the wives of their youth. Leaving them, they were running off, and they were marrying not just any old women. They were, Micah says, specifically marrying women who were pagans. Women who didn't worship God at all. They were disrespecting their own families because people other people no longer matter. In their minds, if they don't matter to God, they shouldn't matter to me. If God's not bringing justice for them, why should I bring justice for them? Brothers and sisters, from a human vantage point, from a purely human vantage point, all of this makes sense. Sinners are prospering, pagans are doing just fine, abusers and thieves and evil people are walking around freely, so God either doesn't care or he's not there at all. It's an argument that you'll still hear today. A lot of people claim there is no God for these very reasons. A lot of people have walked away from faith because they're carrying or listening to or holding on to these talking points. I'll bet at least some of you know people who think this way, who feel this way. But here's the thing. God has shown people throughout the history of the world, and he's shown Israel throughout their nation's history, that this is not true. Just look at what God has done over and over and over again. He has lifted them and carried them over and over and over again. He has forgiven them and healed their land. The problem wasn't that God was never there for them. The problem was they were never there for God. The Lord, do not change. So, you, the descendants of Jacob, you're not destroyed because I never change, right? Ever since the time of your ancestors, you have turned away from my decrees and you have not kept them. You are the one who's changed, not me. God says, return to me. Return to me, and I will return to you. But you ask, how are we to return? Brothers and sisters, this is what he's saying. If you look around and you can't see God, it is not God who left. If you look around and you think, where is God in my life? It's not because God left. Where is God in our agreement? Where is God in my covenant? How come God's not showing up and all this bad stuff is happening? It is not because God left. The whole rest of the book of Malachi, we don't have time to go through that this morning, but it is dedicated to God's promise to remain faithful and stick by those who remain faithful to him. And he's going to rebuild. He's going to do so in such a powerful and tangible way that it's going to be undeniable. And he's going to send them the very help that they are looking for most desperately. And he's making the same promise to you and to me this morning, that if you don't think God is here, or if you don't think God is willing to change your life, God says, test me. If you don't think I'm showing up, just test me. You know, we've never even tried. I used to have this coach, and I hated his guts. And because he would like call me out. And he saw me. I was not very good in football. I was not really good at anything, but especially felt not good at football, even though I was big and even though I got eventually pretty strong. But he would call me out. He was like, you're just not giving me the effort. And I was like, are you kidding? I am sweating and it is hot and I am giving effort. And he was like, no, you're not. And it took months of him drilling that into me before I finally realized how much I was holding back. You know what I'm talking about? Maybe you had a teacher like that or a coach like that, or a parent like that, who would just call you out and say, I can see you're not giving your full effort. You have so much potential. Boy, I hate to see that on a report card. You have so much potential, but you're just not giving it to me. That's what God is telling them, what God is telling us. He's like, you keep expecting to get A pluses. Instead, you're getting Cs because you're giving me C effort at best. You're riding the bench, not because you're not good enough, but because you won't play hard enough. You're not living in a faithful covenant with me, not because I didn't tell you what to do, not because you don't know what to do. but because you're not actually doing it. If you want to see if God can change your life, you've got to actually give your life to God. You can't hold on to some parts of it. You can't hold some back and say, God, I want you to give me all the blessings, but I'm going to be the one to hold on to the purse strings. God, I want you to fix all my marriage and my relationship with my kids or my parents, but I'm going to be the one who makes the decisions about how I treat them. God, I want you to give me the job I want with the people I want, doing what I want, how I want. It's just telling God what to do. That doesn't work. If you want God to change your life, give your whole life to God. He says, test me in this, and you won't be disappointed. So brothers and sisters, this morning, my prayer for you, my prayer for us as a congregation, is that we will be the ones that Malachi calls the remnant. Those who are actually bold enough to say, all right, God, I don't know how this is going to work. I don't know if it'll work. But I'm going to try you. I'm going to give my life to you. I'm going to give my wallet to you, my relationship to you, my job to you, everything I have. I'm going to give it to you. And we'll just see what happens. Because God is faithful. And if we can pray for you this morning, encourage you this morning, lift you up for strength, for forgiveness, for patience, for a new path and a new life. We want you to come now as we stand and as we sing.